Ali and I were at a funeral yesterday, which is lovely. It was a very mother of a very good friend of ours who's and bless her, she'd worked so hard. I mean, she's somebody who did not at all interested in Christianity, but her mother wanted a Christian's funeral service, and the local vicar was dead terrible, but she found a Franciscan priest who was a high Anglican priest, and I in the Church of England, high Anglican means a very interceremonial and actually it's a beautiful little church in Rodborough up in the Stroud Valley, which incidentally had a beautiful pre-Raphaelite window at its east end. And this man was very simply dressed in a white robe and white robe and cowl and a red stole. And was taking us through things that were, in a sense, they were nice, but they were things that, so we listened to Perry Como on the way in and Andy Williams on the way out, because these were songs that really, so Ave Maria in the beginning and Grace, Amazing Grace on the way out. And all of that was kind of lovely and very human, beautiful. But then there was an extraordinary bit right at the end where he makes something called the commendation, where the priest invites the soul of the person, the dead person, to go into the other worlds, to go into the light, to go into the hands of the divine. And he stood at the base of the coffin and explained to us that what he was now going to do was a sort of a ritual blessing of this person. And I would like you all to imagine her going out through the eastern window into the light. And then he did this very powerful, very short commendation. And it's like the church lit up completely and opened out. And you could see, or at least I felt I could see, the soul of this person moving into the light and being embraced by those who have loved him. And then he turned and blessed us. And so, if you like, most of that meeting, even though it was religious, was sort of secular and sort of social. And then suddenly something else comes in. Now, similarly with these stories, we can understand them in all kinds of different ways. We can understand them in social ways, in secular ways, in ways of different levels of understanding, really, relationships between men and women, or political relationships in the Middle Ages. But actually a part of them is this territory of the sacred. And right at the heart of the story, right at the heart of working with these archetypes, is this process of transformation, of the bringing together of opposites, of the bringing together of light and shadow, and of the uniting of the hallows, of the sword and the stone, of the spear and the cup, and the incarnation of light. And this image you had, Rob, of being at the stone and being child and adult and king, and that kind of cycle, that's the repeating pattern that you find moving through the stories. And this image, really, of Arthur as the centre point, and all the acts of the knights being the acts of Arthur, just like the acts of the ladies of the round table, are the acts of Guinevere. Now that's the perspective that we need to hold and to keep coming from here. It's not that the other levels aren't important and interesting, and if we were doing a different kind of course, well then we would look at that. If we were looking at the sociological aspects or the gender politics of Mallory or of Mallory's Mort d'Arthur, well fine, we would look at all of that and that would be the principal object of study. But that isn't our object of study. And I think the place where we segue into thinking, well, what about this? What about that? And why aren't they, and sort of, and, and, um, And obviously, you know, the images I produced are my images worked out for ChatGPT, and I'm, you know, the intention, not perfect images, they're just what I could summon with the help of my computer friend. But the intention of the images was to really, all is to point in that direction of opposites in union. In particular, there's a thread running through it of the fusion of the pagan and the Christian traditions, the inner Christian traditions. And that comes right out of the teachings of my own teacher and the place where Stephen and I were trained, and the, what we would call the Alexandrian tradition, I guess, so that the Christianity and the older traditions are not enemies. They inform each other. They speak powerfully to each other. And this, it's from that synthesis. In a sense, that synthesis is the grail. It is this constantly regenerating, recreating thing. Now, what the story of Arthur gives us in particular is the what happens when we seek to bring the grail to earth. What happens when we seek to create, if you like, a field of possibility that has the balance of the hallows. That is, you know, that has the balance, the correct balance of love and life, of light and law, and then the difficulty of the doing that, and the difficulty of the sustaining of that, and the necessary ending of that, so that some new iteration of the process can occur. You know, if we never died, you know, death is awful and painful, and getting old is horrible beyond belief. You know, you've had your bits of your body, you know, refusing to do as it's told, and you have to do things like, oh God, I have to think consciously about getting down to the floor and wonder and look around for things to help me heave me fast and bulk up again. You know, things that as a young man I would just bounce up and down. But the thing is, if we remain young forever, if we never die, we have to see how static everything inevitably would become. Death is life's meditation. So that place towards the end where we have the Guinevere and Lancelot together, you have Guinevere contemplating the story, purifying the story through her contemplations. We have Lancelot ushering the dead into the light. You know, I just want to read you before we finish it. This is a poem by Charles Williams. And it's called Lancelot's Mass. Let's find it. Because it's the Taliesin watching Lancelot's Mass. This is the actual. So in Charles Williams's poems, he sees himself as Taliesin, as the archetypal poet. And here we have this image of him standing before Mass at the end of the round table. And it goes like this. I came to his altar when dew was bright on the grass. He was not sworn of the priesthood, began the Mass. The altar was an ancient stone laid upon stones. Carbonic's arch, Camelot's wall, frame of boar's bones. In armour before the earthen footbase he stood. On his surcoat the lions of his house dappled with blood. Rampant, regardant, but he wore nor helm or sword. And his hands were bare as laterans to the work of our Lord. In the ritual before the altar, Lancelot began to pass. All the dead lords of the table were drawn from their graves to the Mass. They stood inward turned, as shields on a white rushing deck, between Nimue of Bosulande and Elaine of Carbonac. In Blanchefleur's cell at Almesbury, the Queen Guinevere felt the past exposed and the detail rich sharp and clear. Drew at the draw at the pang in the breast, till rich and reconciled, the mystical milk rose in the mother of Logrith's child. Out of the queen's substitution, the wounded and dead king entered into salvation to serve the holy thing, singly seen in the mass, owning the double crown, going to the altar Peles, and Arthur moving down. Lancelot and Arthur wove the web, the sky opened on moon and sun, between them, light traced on high, the unseen knight of terror, this is death, stood as a friend. Invisible things invisible waited the end. Lancelot came to the cannon, my household stood, around me, bearers of the banners, bounteous in blood, each at the earthen footpace ordained to be blessed and to bless, each than I and than all, lordlier and less. Then at the altar we sung in our office the cycle of names, of their great attributed virtues. The festival of flames fell from new sky to new earth. The light in bands of bitter glory renewed the imperial lands. Then the Byzantine ritual, the epiclesis, began. Then their voice in ours invoked the making of man. Petal on petal floated out of the blossom of the host, and always the Theotokos conceived by the Holy Ghost. We exposed, we exalted the unity. Prism shone web, paths, points. As it was done, the Antipodean zones were retrieved around a white rushing deck, and the acts of the emperor took zenith from Caucasia to Carbonac. Over the altar, flame of anatomized fire, the high prince stood, gyre in burning gyre. Day level before him, night massed behind, the table ascended, the glories intertwined. The table ascended, each in turn, lordliest and least, slave and squire, woman and wizard, poet and priest, interchanged adoration, interdispersed prayer. The ruddy pillar of the infant was the passage of the porphyry stair. That which had been Taliesin rose in the rood, rood as the cross. In the house of Galahad over the altar he stood, manacled by the web, in the web made free. There was no capable song for the joy in me. Joy to new joy, piercing from paths foregone. That which had been Taliesin made joy to a joy unknown. Manifest joy, speeding in a joy unmanifest. Lancelot's voice below sang, Ita missa est, this is the end of the mass. Fast to the Byzantine harbour gather the salvage sails. That which once was Taliesin rides to the barrows of Wales, up the vales of the Wye. If skill be of work or of will, in the dispersed souls and homes of the household, let the company pray for it still. Well, that is an invocation, really, of the ending, of the gathering, of the return of all of the story into something new, that which was Taliesin, coming from a manifest joy to an unmanifest joy. And in a way, that's the, when our friend's mother was ushered into the lights yesterday, the sense of glorification, the sense of magnification, the sense of her being both fully herself and more than herself, that was in the room for a moment as she moved out of the church into the lights, was just extraordinary. And that's really why, that's why there cannot be the balance has to be dynamic and not static. And this idea of the unseen night of terror, which is of course death itself, that standing as a friend and befriending that figure so that we move on to greater glory, greater possibilities. You know, this is in a way what the whole myth ultimately points to. not at a static perfection, but a dynamic movement towards perfection that is never quite attained. And you see this sometimes in some of the great tombs in Egypt. There's the tombs in the 25th dynasty, for example. There's a whole succession of tombs, succession of rooms, that comes eventually to the presence of Osiris, who's the god of death and resurrection. And the rooms get smaller and smaller, and things narrow. And the perspectives narrow, as if you're heading towards the singularity point of the beginning. So that if you come to Osiris, what happens is you get flipped around immediately. So you come to what you think is the end, and the end is the beginning, and the beginning is the end. So that the point of these things, the point of these stories, really, with their difficult contemplations and light and shadowy imagery, is to obstruct the hardness of our hearts. Now, one of the things that you find really in the Bible, in the Book of Ezekiel in particular, is there's a great piece in it where Ezekiel projects his spirit into Jerusalem, into the place where the elders of Zion are creating chaos. They are all locked in their own rooms of imagery. And we are told their hearts have turned to stone. And this is this quality called Avon. This is a self-replicating commitment to separation. Because the heart of stone can no longer reflect, can no longer respond. It's in a certain sense, the image that they're giving us is the idol within us having ossified into this carved stone piece, which may even be beautiful in its carvings, but has no longer the capacity for life, and can only therefore reflect its own mastery, its own beauty, its own understanding. And as such has become entirely separated off from the great bundle of the living. Because when you're in touch with the bundle of the living, each and all, each movement, each act of intention, each action by any of the great web of being alters the whole web. And so continually we're in the place of construction, deconstruction. The great myth of Camelot and of the round table and of the end of the round table is in some ways quite a detailed exploration of all of that. Now, when we did the meditation at the end of the day today, which really involved a visit to the Rollright stones, and as you know, I don't plan these things. They're just what happens when I I just describe what I'm seeing. But what it took us to really was the essence, again another way of approaching the essence of the stories, where we encounter the hallows that are the hallows of the Grail, that are the aspects of the Grail in relationship. So we encounter that quality of the sword that opens the way or closes the way, that brings this sense of clarity and liberation. We come into that sense of sovereignty with the rod. We come into that sense of being part of the great line of light, of those who mediate the light. We come then into the mystery of the cup and the cauldron, and the mystery of the mothers, and the mystery of the seven sisters that are deep in the stars, that then return us to a place which is the living stone, that is the that is not the stone heart, that is the place that contains the sword of light, that is the hold, that is the throne that we sit on, that is the place our sovereignty arises out of. And in a way that's the purpose of this whole sort of collection of stories. Now, what's useful about the various night stories, and tomorrow as well as looking at the experience of Galahad, we're going to take a little look at the Gawain and the Green Knight. And because what happens, so this is the meta story, the big story. And then if we look at the acts of Arthur, these are factuals, these particular stories. They show us the, in a sense, the Cyrille story is yet to be told. We haven't really touched on that today. But certainly the rest of the Gawain story is a version of, like a fractal of all the stories we've been looking at. And again, that story is going to weave in and out of our weekends, because it's a relatively short story, but it's so much compressed within it. And but today, you know, this weekend in particular, we've made a jump from looking at the Mabinogi into this whole complex medieval world, which is helpful even in its complexity, because it's much nearer the modern consciousness. And in a way, the for each of us now, we have to find a relationship with this in our own way. You may not be that interested in it, don't have to be interested in it, but if you are interested in it, it can help you in this task of deepening your connection with your own spirit and looking at the light and shadow that we all bear with inside ourselves. So there we are. That's come to our end for the day. So have a good evening. I'm very sorry there's no Strictly to watch tonight, but I shall no doubt find something to watch. And, just for your information, everybody knows I watch, after one of the years, I always watch really rubbish TV, but fun TV. And throughout the winter, I've been happily watching Strictly. But now there is no Strictly. And the voice has not yet returned. Damn it.
Have you been watching Traitors?
Oh, God, yes, have I been watching Traitors. Wonderful. Best season ever. Excellent.
Absolutely. Tomorrow you've got the Great Pottery Throwdown, which is good.
That is true. I do enjoy the Great Pottery Throwdown. That is the fun. But yes, Traitors is wonderful. The Traitors are brilliant this time. The two Traitors, they're excellent.
The best Traitors, definitely.
Oh, definitely.
Definitely the best as well. I have something with pets in. Pets are nice.
Yeah, oh. Pets are nice. I agree. Pets are very nice.
Have you got a second to tell us about your wild cat encounter?
Oh, right, can do, if people are interested. We went to, it was recently my birthday, so Ali brought me the cheetah experience, which meant that Bristol Zoo had moved out of Bristol, and they'd opened a kind of a wildlife park, that which is actually, I think, a lot nicer for the animals. And we got to go and feed the cheetahs, and they were amazing. The beauty of these two young male cheetahs, who are huge. I haven't realized quite how big cheetahs are. They're really very big, and have these incredible golden eyes. So we got to go and hide quail all over their enclosure. And the other thing we got to do was to spray perfume on a sack, just ordinary perfume, not special perfume or musk or cheetah musk or anything, because they love rolling on top of strongly perfumed things. So we had this wonder.
Are they in the cage at the time? Are they in the cage at the time?
No, they're not in the cage at the time, because they'd eat you. they're not pets really, because they're dealing very responsibly with. But you do get to see them. It's just a fence separating you and them, as you're lobbing quails over to them. So you get a very full on, very close up encounter. Really, it was magical. So yes, I thoroughly recommend the cheetah encounter. Although my favourite ever animal encounter was the aardvark experience that Ali brought me one year at Longleat, because aardvarks hug you as you feed them, and that's a very nice full-bodied experience.
Yeah,
Anyway, enough of that.
Quite fitting, Ian, because it sounds like the cheaters were on a quail quest.
They were definitely on a, actually they really were on a quail fest. Because they then got to watch them hunting out the quails and then quarrelling with each other about whose quail was whose, really. It was quite fun.
Brilliant.
Okay, guys.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Have a good evening, everybody. Have a good evening. See you in the morning at 10 o'clock.
See you tomorrow.
Bye.
Bye.
Bye. Thank God.